The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 351, The Lesser Understood Sterling McMurrin, The Formative Years on the Ranch and in the City, and The Washington Years at Home and Abroad, a panel discussion including Jackson Newell and Boyer Jarvis.
We have about an hour, and we have two sterling papers, I say literally, and therefore we ought to get right underway. My name is Jack Newell. This session is entitled The Lesser Known Sterling McMurrin, having to do with his youth and his exploits outside of his native Utah and California. Joining me here at the podium is my longtime colleague, Boyer Jarvis. Boyer is a professor of communication at the University of Utah, emeritus, former associate academic vice president for the University of Utah, and in Sterling's words, and I think echoed by many of us, in his years in that role, which were many, I think Boyer was the conscience of the university, constantly reminding us of the need for the university to stand up for what it stands for, and that it might also operate in a manner which was fair and in all ways appropriate to the kind of institution that it aspires to be. So I came to the University of Utah 22 years ago when Boyer was in this role, and immediately came to respect what he did at the university and for the university. But I came later to know what Boyer also does in the community, where he has been a tireless champion of Utah's children, of Utah's minorities, of the free expression of ideas, and many other good things that we have enjoy and that have made this community a much better one for all of us to live in. Boyer was a close friend of Sterling since the 1930s, much longer than I, and you will see in his paper today reflection of many of his early experiences with Sterling as well as his later experiences when he served as Sterling's aide during the years that McMurrin was the United States Commissioner of Education. Both of these periods of time we will be hearing about through Boyer's remarks. He will speak first, and I will speak second, and I will address my remarks to Sterling's formative influences and early years, particularly here in Utah, his school years. With no further ado, may I introduce Boyer Jarvis.
Thank you very much, Jack. My purpose today is to provide some information about two periods in Sterling M. McMurrin's illustrious career, two periods with which I have personal acquaintance. The first is years in Arizona. The second is years in Washington, D.C. When Brother Sterling McMurrin drove into Mesa, Arizona on a hot September day in 1940, he was 26 years of age. 3 months earlier, he had celebrated the second anniversary of his Salt Lake Temple marriage to his University of Utah sweetheart, Natalie Cotterill. And only a few days earlier, he had finished summer school as a graduate student in philosophy at the University of Southern California. As an employee of the Department of Education of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Brother McMurrin, having already been a full-time seminary teacher for 2 years in Richfield, Utah, and 1 year in Montpelier, Idaho, was about to begin a 2-year tour of duty as principal and teacher in the LDS seminary across the street from Mesa Union High School, where I was about to begin my senior year as a high school student. In their mid-20s, Sterling and Natalie McMurrin were an extremely attractive and vivacious couple. Very soon after their arrival in Mesa, Sterling was called to be a member of the Maricopa State Sunday School Board, and on more than one occasion, when she accompanied her husband on official visits to Sunday schools in the outlying wards of the stake, Natalie was invited to sing for the congregation. At the Mesa Seminary, Brother McMurrin shared the teaching chores with his one assistant, Eugene Bryson, and in April of 1941, when Brother Bryson asked to be released from his contract with the Church Department of Education in order to accept a much better paying job with Studebaker Pacific in California, Sister McMurrin took over Bryson's classes for the remainder of the school year. During the summer of 1941, Sterling and Natalie returned to Los Angeles, where he continued graduate study in the School of Philosophy at USC. Here I would like to quote a couple of paragraphs from a letter dated dated July 15, 1941. Dear Brother McMurrin, I have completed reading your material on the worth of man and am very favorably impressed with it. The subject is very fully treated, and you have made an excellent contribution in gathering together the New Testament materials on the subject. Some of it may be a bit difficult for 9th and 10th grade students, and yet I do not see how you could have simplified it much more. We are really very grateful to you for your contribution. I am sure you have the graduate bug to such an extent that you will never be happy until you push through for a higher degree. And I am also sure that you should, within a reasonable time, complete this graduate work. My thought was that if you spend at least another year in the department and establish yourself as an institute teacher, you could then get a leave of absence on that basis and assure yourself of a much better position on your return. That is to say, if you left us as an institute man, it would ensure a position for you later on, whereas if you went now, you would have to take your chances along with the others upon your return. I'm personally very much interested in seeing you stay in the Church Department of Education because I feel you can make a great contribution in this field. I am hoping, therefore, that you can arrange to have a scholarship provided for you 1 year hence at the university. I think it might be well for you to keep Dr. West informed of your present opportunities for a scholarship. I'm sure he has no disposition to want to handicap you in getting your advanced degree. There may be some question from our point of view as to whether you should get it in philosophy or in religion. The latter, naturally, would be preferable. The letter is signed by M. Lynn Bennion, who in 1941 was the supervisor of seminaries for the Church Department of Education. The Dr. West to whom he referred was Franklin L. West, the Church Commissioner of Education. When Brother and Sister McMurrin returned to Mesa for the 1941-42 school year, the number two man at the Mesa Seminary was George T. Boyd. While managing the seminary in Mesa, Sterling found an opportunity to teach more advanced and mature students on the campus of Arizona State Teachers College at Tempe. The religious conference, as formally recognized by the college, was a program of religious instruction offered by several cooperating ministers, a rabbi, and a Mormon professor of agriculture at the college. Some of their courses were accepted as elective credits toward graduation, and at the invitation of the religious conference, Sterling M. McMurrin taught a survey of world religions, the philosophy of religion, and a seminar in religious cultures. He also taught a non-credit course in conjunction with the Tempe Ward MIA, on the philosophy of Mormonism. In addition to his activities in managing and teaching at the Mesa Seminary, teaching in the religious conference at Tempe, and serving on the Maricopa State Sunday School Board, Sterling McMurrin made time in 1941 to prepare and deliver a series of Sunday talks on Mormonism over the premier radio station in Arizona, KTAR in Phoenix. In one of those radio addresses, he stated that the guiding principle of Mormonism is the simple but wholesome idea that man, by his very nature, is inherently good, and that his basic natural tendencies are not to be destroyed, but rather to be cultivated and encouraged through a living process of practical education that has as its goal the realization of a perfectly integrated and normal personality. Naturally, the importance of the intellectual life looms large in this picture, for it not only represents a broad area in itself, but is especially significant due to the necessity of a rational guidance for all growth and experience. Truth, the object of reason, must ever be a basic ideal in religion. And continuing in the same address, Brother McMurrin observed that in Mormon philosophy, the human soul is essentially an eternally existing intelligence, timeless, without beginning or end. The entire process of living, therefore, in the pre-existent state in this life or in the life to come, is regarded as a never-ending experience of education. And near the end of that radio talk, he said, our main interest as a church, of course, lies in the religious aspect of education. In this regard, our basic objective in every agency and effort is to assist and direct the individual in the creation of a religious personality that is firmly grounded in a deep consciousness of the reality of God and a realization of man's relationship to Him. This consciousness necessarily has many implications and suggests a large variety of secondary objectives, but it must always be kept in the foreground. It is here that religion must make its distinctive contribution to personal growth. Accordingly, we regard religious education in a realistic light that makes it not merely a confession of faith, the acquisition of a body of information, or the vanities of mere speculation, but a matter of real living. Experience itself is the test, and until religious knowledge creates a real difference in the actual life of the individual, we cannot regard him as in any way educated. At the conclusion of the 1941-42 school year, Brother and Sister McMurrin said farewell to their many friends and admirers in Mesa, Tempe, and Phoenix, and returned again to Los Angeles, where Sterling continued his graduate study at the University of Southern California until the end of August 1943. Here it's worth remembering that the Arizona years in Sterling McMurrin's career roughly coincided with the time of World War II. Like all patriotic Americans, he wanted to serve his country in the fight for freedom and against the forces of tyranny. But because of chronic bronchial asthma, his draft classification was 4F, which made him ineligible to serve. He made several unsuccessful attempts to obtain a chaplain's commission in both the Army and the Navy. In September of 1943, Sterling and Natalie McMurrin arrived in Tucson, where he was assigned to be the director of the LDS Institute adjacent to the University of Arizona. There he received a warm welcome, not only from the Institute students and the local saints, but also from officials at the university. The positive reception accorded to Sterling M. McMurrin at the University of Arizona was based both on his own impressive academic credentials and upon the solid academic accomplishments of his two predecessors. Lowell L. Bennion, the founding director of the LDS Institute at the University of Arizona in 1937, had earned his doctorate at the University of Strasbourg. And Darrell Chase, his successor in 1939, held a Ph.D. in religion from the University of Chicago. When Dr. Chase learned that he was about to be transferred to a much larger institute at Utah State Agricultural College in Logan, and that Sterling McMurrin would replace him in Tucson, he wrote a detailed letter to orient Sterling to the job he was about to undertake and offered advice regarding places to buy groceries and gasoline and haircuts and so forth. In that letter, dated March 29, 1943, Dr. Chase commented as follows: "I know that you will enjoy living in Tucson, where you will advance the work of the church and leave a living monument to yourself. Brother, you already have a following here. Next to Jesus and the prophet Joseph, you are at present quoted more often by LDS students than all the other worthies, both modern and ancient." Like the directors and their families who preceded them, Sterling and Natalie occupied a small upstairs apartment at the back of the Institute building. While that arrangement was not without its drawbacks, such as lack of complete privacy, it enabled the director to perform all of his teaching, administrative, and custodial duties without leaving the premises. The Institute building included, in addition to a director's apartment, the chapel, a recreation hall, library, classroom, lounge and study areas, and the director's office. The Institute was a social gathering place, not only for Mormon students attending the university, but also for Mormon servicemen stationed in or near Tucson. If I'm not mistaken, the long-standing friendship of William Mulder and Sterling McMurrin began when Ensign or Lieutenant J.G. Mulder visited the Institute while he was enrolled in a naval officers training program at the University of Arizona. The high point of the week at the Institute when Brother McMurrin was director was Sunday school. We assembled in the chapel at 9:30 a.m. to listen to the CBS radio broadcast of music and the spoken word from the Crossroads of the West. And then after the standard opening exercises, we listened to the director's always uplifting, intellectually stimulating, and thoroughly original lessons. It was my privilege to be Brother McMurrin's Sunday school superintendent. My successor was Stuart Udall. Brother McMurrin enjoyed cordial relations with the officials and members of the Southern Arizona State presided over by Alonzo Ballantyne, a son-in-law of Apostle Joseph F. Merrill, and the Tucson Ward, whose bishop was Gordon Kimball, a brother of Spencer W. Kimball, whose summons to an apostleship was yet to come. While he was in Tucson, Brother McMurrin served on the Southern Arizona State High Council. Evidence of the academic standing of the Tucson Institute with the University of Arizona appeared in a statement printed on the back of the university's class schedule each semester during the mid-1940s. The statement titled Related Courses in Religion read as follows. The Institute of Religion, sponsored by the LDS Church, offers two courses in religion which may be transferred to the university for degree credit. Students interested register directly with the Institute, 1000 North Mountain Avenue. The courses have the value of 2 units each and are not to appear on the university registration card, but are considered in the total schedule carried by the student, and such registration must be approved by the student's dean. Each semester, that statement was followed by the titles and class meeting times of the two courses currently being offered. Courses offered by Mr. McMurrin included the teachings of Jesus and the prophets, the history of Christian thought, Oriental religions, world religions, and religion in the modern world. Not surprisingly, some Tucson ministers envied the Mormon Institute's academic affiliation with the University of Arizona. To counter the minister's efforts to disrupt that affiliation, the non-Mormon head of the university's Department of Philosophy and Psychology proposed to make the institute director a university faculty member. But before such an appointment could be arranged, Mr. McMurrin had agreed to accept an assistant professorship in the School of Philosophy at the University of Southern California. Nevertheless, confirmation of the University of Arizona's high regard for Sterling McMurrin is found in the following letter dated January 15, 1946. Dear Mr. McMurrin, Commissioner West has just informed me that you have accepted a position in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Southern California. May I congratulate you on the fine opportunity this brings. We are very sorry that you are leaving the Institute here. We have enjoyed your fine standards as a scholar and your excellent attitude of cooperation. I predict for you large success in your new associations. Sincerely yours, Alfred Atkinson, President. During the 5 semesters that Sterling and Natalie were in charge of the Tucson Institute, they cultivated lasting friendships with students, servicemen, members of the Tucson Ward, and people in the university community. From time to time, Brother and Sister McMurrin hosted official visitors from Salt Lake City. One of my favorite recollections is Sterling's report of Apostle Widsoe's parting admonition as they stood on the front steps of the Institute at the end of the Apostle's visit. Preach the gospel, sugarcoat it when necessary. The following letter reflects the quality of hospitality that the McMurrins typically provided their guests from Utah. Dear Sterling and Natalie, I've just arrived home and take this opportunity to again express my deep appreciation for your many kindnesses extended to me during my stay in Tucson. I enjoyed greatly the lovely spirit and sweet humility you both express, and could only wish that my own girls were under your influence. The care you gave me both as to my clothes and other personal kindnesses could hardly have been extended more lovingly by my own mother. I should only hope for the time when you have drawn closer to us here or elsewhere. With kindest regards, I am sincerely and affectionately yours, Harold B. Lee. Perhaps the most significant development of the McMurrin sojourn in Tucson for them personally was the birth of the first two of their 5 children. Now I'll fast forward from January 1946 to January 1961. One midweek evening, a few days before the inauguration of President John F. Kennedy, Sterling invited Waldemar Reed and me to join him for lime flips at Dan Johnson's Ice Cream Parlor on the corner of 9th East and 7th South, where the Dodo restaurant is now located. As we slurped our lime flips, Sterling asked Waldemar and me if he should leave the University of Utah and take a job in Washington, D.C., a job from which the current occupant was about to be fired. Tell us more, Waldemar and I responded almost simultaneously. And so Stirling told us that Alvin Urich, president of the Fund for the Advancement of Education, had called to ask him if he would accept appointment as the United States Commissioner of Education if the job were offered to him. As we talked, Waldemar and I recognized that the call from Al Urich suggested to Stirling the possibility of service to his country, which had been withheld from him during World War II. Life for Stirling McBurn suddenly became quite hectic. He called Dr. Urich and told him he would accept the job if it were offered. A day or two after the inauguration of President Kennedy, Stirling flew to Washington, D.C. to meet Abraham Ribicoff, the new Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. The two of them developed an immediate respect and liking for each other, and as Dr. McMurrin departed for his flight back to Salt Lake City, Secretary Ribicoff told Dr. McMurrin that he would ask the President to appoint him to the position of United States Commissioner of Education. The Secretary's recommendation was regarded favorably at the White House, but before the appointment could be settled, political protocol required clearance from the Utah Democratic Party officials. With that formality accomplished, the White House announced on January 31, 1961, that President Kennedy would nominate Dr. Stirling M. McMurrin to be the new United States Commissioner of Education. As U.S. Commissioner of Education designate, Dr. McMurrin still was performing his duties as the University of Utah Vice President for Academic Affairs. During February and March, he commuted frequently between Salt Lake and Washington, D.C., while he negotiated with President A. Ray Alpin for a leave of absence from the university, while he conferred with staff members of the U.S. Office of Education, and while he waited for Senate confirmation of his appointment. To most of the leaders of national educational organizations, as well as to many of the political pundits in the nation's capital, President Kennedy's selection for United States Commissioner of Education of a philosophy professor who was not and never had been a member of the National Education Association or of any local teachers' association was something of a surprise. For as long as most interested people could remember, the influence of the National Education Association had been strongly felt in the U.S. Office of Education. Now, suddenly, the future of that influence seemed unclear. But while some people wondered what an unknown philosophy professor from Utah, of all places, could do in Washington, D.C., many people who knew Stirling McMurrin hastened to congratulate him. On February 1, 1961, President David O. McKay wrote, "Dear Dr. McMurrin, among the many thousands who are happy over your appointment as United States Commissioner of Education, I take this opportunity to express appreciation of President Kennedy's good judgment in choosing you for this high and responsible position, and to assure you of my affectionate regards, confidence, and heartfelt wishes for your unbounded success. Sister McKay joins in every good wish for you and Sister McMurrin in your service to the nation. Affectionately, David O. McKay." After the formal committee hearings, at which both Utah Senators Wallace Bennett and Frank Moss strongly endorsed his appointment, Dr. McMurrin received unanimous confirmation by the Senate at the end of March. The swearing-in ceremony for the new United States Commissioner of Education was conducted by Secretary Ribicoff on April 4, 1961, in the auditorium of the Health, Education, and Welfare Building. Following the ceremony, the National Education Association staged a reception for the new commissioner in its elegant headquarters building. Among the hundreds of persons attending that reception, the one person, other than the honoree and Mrs. McMurrin, who attracted the most attention was Stirling and Natalie's good friend, Walter Reuther. Later, William Carr, Executive Secretary of the NEA, thanked Commissioner McMurrin for bringing Mr. Reuther to the National Education Association headquarters and confided that for years, the NEA's efforts to entice the renowned labor leader to visit the office had been unsuccessful. With a staff of approximately 1,200 civil service employees in the U.S. Office of Education, the commissioner was allowed to have two non-civil service assistants. Stirling invited me to be one of those two. By June of 1961, he and I had settled our families within about a mile of each other in nearby Arlington, Virginia. Most days we rode together to the office, 12 to 14-hour days plus 6 or more hours on Saturday was our normal work schedule. Invitations rapidly accumulated from across the country for Commissioner McMurrin to speak at seminars, conferences, conventions, commencements, and so forth. To the amazement of the staff in the office, Dr. McMurrin either wrote his own speeches or spoke extemporaneously. Among the themes he built upon were the necessity for more rigorous standards at all levels of the educational process, more recognition and better compensation for public school teachers, particularly in inner-city schools, and the elimination of racial segregation in all the schools of the nation. He also advocated substantial increases in federal aid to education and maintained that such support could be made available without infringing upon the treasured American tradition of local control of the public schools. Commissioner McMurrin's ability to discuss with compelling clarity the challenges confronting the United States in competition with totalitarian states seeking to extend their influence around the world caught the attention of members of Congress, of high-level officials in many federal government agencies outside the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Soon he was engaged in ongoing conversations with representatives of the Department of State, the National Science Foundation, and so forth, regarding ways to enhance the quality and availability of education for the protection of individual freedom and national sovereignty. Representatives of the United States Chamber of Commerce, who had long regarded the U.S. Office of Education as a mere extension of the National Education Association, welcomed the opportunity to have their views considered by a different kind of U.S. Commissioner of Education, who recognized that business had legitimate interests in the shaping of federal educational policies. Commissioner McMurrin's advocacy of greatly increased federal expenditures in support of education was not universally approved. For example, Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, who in 1961 probably was anticipating his 1964 campaign for the presidency, suggested in his newspaper column that massive federal aid to education would inevitably undermine the authority of local school boards and result in tyrannical central control of the nation's schools. The Maryland State Teachers Association, reacting to a newspaper report of a talk in which Commissioner McMurrin had called for greater emphasis on high standards in the preparation of teachers, passed a resolution vigorously denouncing the commissioner for questioning the quality of all teacher education programs throughout the United States. On the other hand, Sister Mary Josetta, RSM, president of St. Xavier College in Chicago, addressed a letter on December 22, 1961, to President Kennedy to express the appreciation of many educational leaders for Commissioner McMurrin's contributions in helping to shape constructive educational policies. She wrote, "Dear Mr. President, during his months in office, we have watched and listened, first with interest, then with admiration, to Mr. Sterling McMurrin, Commissioner of Education. While I have not had the occasion to welcome him to our campus, we have been deeply conscious of his presence. Never in my 20 years in higher education has there been so able and articulate a representative of education in government. Mr. McMurrin's statement before the Appropriations Subcommittee of the House of Representatives last May 8, the present condition of American education, was one of the clearest, most cogent arguments for the value of liberal education I have read. Having spent the past 15 years in the development and implementation of liberal education on all levels, it is a source of hope, encouragement, and I think progress to see the enduring goals in education of free men hold first place in the minds of our country's leaders. Mr. McMurrin's extraordinary capabilities are recognized and deeply appreciated by those of us who share his work." In February of 1962, Commissioner McMurrin agreed to visit a newly created educational television center in Columbia, South Carolina. He invited me and Keith Engar, who was then working on a one-year assignment with the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C., to accompany him. Traveling together, the three of us took an overnight train and arrived at about a.m. in Columbia. We were met at the depot and taken to the ETV center. After touring the facilities and watching a demonstration of one of South Carolina's television programs for use in the public schools, we were luncheon guests of several of the state public education officials. By 2 p.m., the purpose of our trip to Columbia was served, and we had about 5 hours to wait before boarding the overnight train back to Washington, D.C. Recognizing a golden opportunity for some much-needed rest, Sterling suggested that we rent a hotel room and lie down for the remainder of the afternoon. Keith and I readily agreed. The room we rented had 2 single beds. Keith and I told Sterling that he should take one of the beds and the two of us would flip for the other one. Sterling would not agree to our proposal. He insisted on being a party to the coin toss. He lost and ended up resting on the floor. Keith and I were so chagrined that we found lying on those beds anything but restful. A project to which Commissioner McMurrin devoted a great deal of attention during the early months of 1962 was a U.S. Office of Education conference on the ideals of American education and the international dimensions of education held in Washington, D.C., March 25th to 28th. Some 200 college university presidents and professors, officers of national education organizations, representatives of state and federal government officials were invited to participate. As the keynote for that conference, Commissioner McMurrin prepared a major address titled Education for Freedom in a Free Society. A few days after the conclusion of that memorable event, Sterling told me that Abraham Ribicoff had confided to him his intention to resign as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare and become a candidate for the United States Senate from Connecticut. Before joining the Kennedy administration, Ribicoff had been governor of Connecticut, and as a cabinet officer, he was growing weary of the requirement that he have all of his public policy statements reviewed and approved in advance by the White House. By becoming a senator, he could regain the freedom to speak his mind independently. Commissioner McMurrin had enjoyed his close working relationship with Secretary Ribicoff. In a little more than a year's time, the two of them had managed dramatically to raise the prestige and enlarge the influence of the U.S. Office of Education. Now, with Ribicoff planning to move on, Sterling told me confidentially he felt inclined to move back to Utah. The final months of Sterling McMurrin's service in the Office of Education were marked by continuing progress for education bills, which he was supporting before congressional committees. Bills to build more classrooms, to increase teachers' salaries, to provide scholarships for teachers and for college students preparing for teaching careers were all being considered. One day in July of 1962, when Commissioner McMurrin entered a planning meeting in his office with a small group of staff members working on education legislation, he sensed an unusual somberness in their demeanor. When he asked why everyone seemed so discouraged, he was informed that the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, had just ruled unconstitutional the New York State public school prayer. Noticing that one of the staff members looked especially downcast, Commissioner McMurrin jokingly said something to the effect, "Peter, I'm surprised. You look like you wrote that prayer yourself." To which Peter Muirhead replied, "I did." Before joining the U.S. Office of Education, Peter Muirhead, as a staff member in the New York State Office of Education, had composed the 22-word Regent's Prayer that the highest court in the land now declared to be an infringement of religious freedom. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee, and we beg Thy blessing upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. The summer of 1962 passed quickly. On September 5th, Commissioner McMurrin met with several hundred employees of the U.S. Office of Education in the auditorium of the Health, Education, and Welfare Building. He thanked them for their dedication and service to their country and told them he was resigning because he wanted to return to teaching and research. He said it was the resignation of Mr. Ribicoff from the department that prompted me to submit my own resignation, simply because I felt that this would be an appropriate time for me to make such a move. On September 8th, President Kennedy signed this letter. "Dear Dr. McMurrin, it is with deep regret that I accept your resignation as Commissioner of Education. I would like to express to you my personal gratitude for your dedication and loyalty. The field in which you have directed your efforts is a vital one to all of the American people, and your contribution as commissioner has benefited the nation as a whole. In whatever future course you may follow, you have my very best wishes for success and happiness. Sincerely, John Kennedy. And on October 2nd, by which time Professor McMurrin was at home on the University of Utah campus, Senator John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky made the following statement on the floor of the United States Senate. A few days ago, a great public servant left the scene of public affairs and started back to the college campus to his classes in philosophy. Dr. Sterling McMurrin, who has served as U.S. Commissioner of Education for something less than 2 years, called together the staff of the Office of Education to bid them adieu. He gave them more than a warm personal message. He spoke to them of his philosophy of education, of public service, of life in all its aspects. Dr. McMurrin is a scholar and a civilized man. But scholar though he has never confined himself or his thoughts to an ivory tower, to a world limited to academic walls. He was appointed by a Democratic president, but Sterling McMurrin followed no partisan political pattern, no partisan political procedures. He followed the dictates of his conscience and the mandates of great thinkers of all ages, the Eastern wise men, the classic Greek philosophers, the leaders who gave the world the Judeo-Christian code of moral living, and the thoughtful writings of the scholastics of the Middle Ages to the beginnings of modern philosophy. With this knowledge, he sought to give direction, but never directives, to education. He spoke of the tremendous importance of the individual and sought to emphasize the overwhelming necessity today for the personal and intellectual integrity of the individual. I trust this will not mark the departure of Dr. McMurrin from an active role in shaping policy for American education. We need him to help provoke thought, even though he may wish to leave the arena of public administration. I hope a way will be found to keep his intellectual leadership before the nation. And as I say, the rest is history.
Thank you, Boyer. I notice with interest that the sign on the back of the door there says that we're meeting in the harvest room. And indeed, I think we've just seen the harvest of a great life. And it's my privilege now to talk a little bit about the planting and nurturing of that life, the formative years. With the passing of Sterling McMurrin and Lowell Bunyan this year, we have heard countless friends and admirers in very diverse settings utter words and phrases like irreplaceable, the end of an era, the last of a breed, to describe our feelings. What you and I will miss, and continue to miss for a long time, is not so much their voices or their ideas as their way of being in the world and their way of being Mormon. How does a life like Sterling McMurrin's happen? What kind of a family, immediate and extended, nurtured him? What sorts of ideas were lodged in his minds by that family as a child and as an inquiring college student? What principles guided his actions in the bloom of his life as an extraordinary thinker and doer? And why did he find such pleasure in his existence right up to the final moments of his life this spring? I raised these questions in a paper I gave at the Mormon History Association in May, but my purpose there was not to answer them. Rather, it was to discuss the challenges and problems of writing about Sterling's life more generally. But I relish the opportunity now to return to these questions, because they are important not only to understanding Sterling's unique gifts, but perhaps more importantly, his approach to life and living. Let's look first and briefly at the qualities that distinguished the man. He had a keen sense of duty, in his own words, an overdeveloped conscience. He felt intense loyalty to family, church, nation, and university. Not only the University of Utah, but the notion of a university itself. These institutions deserved his and our loyalty, he believed, because they are the conveyors of culture and values. It is they that make us human. He believed rational thought and free expression of ideas offered the last best hope for making these institutions, and therefore individual human beings, just and humane. He believed in the dignity of the individual person and in self-expression and self-determination within the limits of what he believed to be an indifferent universe. When injustices were visited upon individuals by institutions, he felt a genuine sense of moral indignation, that impelled him to act. And his mode of protest was to point out with unmistakable clarity the irrationality and ironies of the motivations and actions that sometimes characterized institutions like the LDS Church. Despite his lofty reputation and great ability, he didn't take himself too seriously. He was a private man who rarely revealed his spiritual life and religious sentiments, but they ran strong and deep. He was, throughout his life, concerned with the possibilities as well as the absurdities of religion. On the possibilities, consider this statement which he wrote just about a year ago. Religion should bring consecration to life and direction to human endeavor, inspire men and women with faith in themselves, dedicate them to high moral purpose, and preserve their natural piety in the presence of success, giving them strength to live through their failures with nobility and face with high courage their supreme tragedies. Although Sterling McMurrin spent nearly half his adult years in high leadership positions in education, including those periods that Boyer Jarvis has just spoken of, he was fundamentally a thinker, writer, and speaker, a consummate man of ideas who frequently found himself in the thick of university, church, and government affairs, bridging thought and practice, ideals and reality. I return then to my theme today, where did such a person come from? Before jumping entirely onto the nurture side of the nature-nurture debate, we must recognize that Sterling McMurrin was endowed by nature with extraordinary rational powers and that he possessed remarkable gifts of language and of memory. His younger brother, Hal, said to me several weeks ago, by the time Sterling reached high school, we all knew there was something special in our family, and we just watched him evolve. He was a brilliant student in school and in college. There were many brilliant students, however, then and now, so we turn to the nurture side of the equation to explore McMurrin's distinctive philosophy of life and the moral compass that gave direction to his intellect. William Perry, in his classic analysis of moral and ethical development, concludes that there is nothing more important in youth than the presence of strong, positive role models. And the more and varied they are, the richer the environment for the child. Let me repeat, there is nothing more important in youth than the presence of strong and positive role models. And the more and varied they are, the richer the environment for the youth. If this is true, then the conditions of Sterling's formative years were nearly ideal. If you ask him about his early years, he spoke first and most about his two grandfathers, then about his mother, and then about his grandmothers, and finally about his father. All were important to him, and his three brothers, incidentally, were woven throughout his stories of his youth. Children of two of them are with us here today. On the other side, On the one side, the McMurrin line was Joseph W. McMurrin, his grandfather, who enjoyed the height of his considerable oratorical powers and church influence as a member of the First Council of the 70 when Sterling was growing up. He was dignified, distant, and completely identified with the Mormon church hierarchy. Like his fellow 70 and lifelong friend B.H. Roberts, however, he was an intellectual at the core. Sterling credited his philosophical interests and academic predispositions to his grandfather, McMurrin. Even so, the regular Thursday evening family gatherings at his home were remembered by Sterling and his brothers as formal occasions, quote, rather tame affairs, something sometimes rather boring in comparison to the spirited mosses. His gracious but sometimes forbidding grandmother McMurrin inspired awe towards her husband and sometimes toward herself. This was a family of high station and calling in Utah society and in the church, and the four brothers McMurrin sensed it and no doubt found it bracing. Grandfather Moss probably enjoyed even greater station in Utah society, but he was chiefly a man of affairs, a banker, entrepreneur, and for nearly 40 years, general manager and a co-founder, incidentally, of the Deseret Land and Livestock Company of northeastern Utah, one of the largest ranches in the West. When my grandfather William Moss walked down the street, Sterling remarked, people would step back and watch him pass. Brothers spent every summer of their youths on the home ranch near Woodruff, working on the sheep and cattle ranch. William Moss was always in charge, always fair, and generally partial to his grandson Sterling, who, Hal remembers, always got whichever job assignment he asked for. Often it was riding with his grandfather from one part of the ranch to another, coordinating the large operation. Whatever his tasks, Sterling's ranch experience cut deeply into his schooling. He always left for the high country before school recess for the summer, and seldom returned in the fall until long after school had resumed again. His older brother Keith remembered an Eastern woman who was visiting the ranch one summer, leaning over Sterling and giving him a hug before she left to return to the East. "You poor little dear. If I could just take you home with me to the city, you could go to school and learn something." He was learning plenty, of course, that schools don't teach at all. Here he developed a profound respect for practical decision-making, for hands-on work, and for the people who do these things well. It was here, too, that he acquired a lifelong passion for horses. Hal recalls that they would sometimes ride the range from dawn to dusk, come home and have dinner, and then go back out and just lean on the fence and watch the horses eat under the moonlight. This was a compelling life, full of excitement, and William Moss loved it and made it all work. Nearing death, he asked for the paperwork on the loans that were owed to him by many people during the Depression who had farms. Remember, he was also a banker. He asked on his deathbed to have all these papers brought to him and then had them burned before his very eyes, freeing scores of people from farm debts amassed during the Depression. The amount of those notes was $260,000, which was a whale of a lot of money 50 years ago. Sterling's mother, Gertrude Moss, loved the robust and free life of the ranch as well. She accompanied her sons to the Deseret Ranch every summer, or rather they accompanied her, serving as the coordinator and chief cook for as many as 50 ranch hands a day. She loved to dance, she told captivating stories, and she was an easy match for any McMurrin or Moss. She was quite a catch even for a McMurrin, Hal remembers. They all looked up to my mother. Sterling described her as one of the most open-minded and approachable people he ever knew. At the same time, she was, during the two-thirds of the year that she spent in Ogden, completely devoted to the church and served for years as Relief Society president and other callings. But almost always on her own terms. Hal continued, "She was a free thinker. In today's term, she would be a real feminist, very much in control of her own thinking and of her own life." Sterling's father, Joseph W. McMurrin, Jr., was a school teacher in Utah and later a probation officer in Los Angeles. But Sterling claimed that he was really a misplaced English professor, and Hal remarks that his greatest talent was as a musician. Whatever he was, Joseph Jr. possessed a quiet intellectual temperament, loved words and ideas, and was always a defender of the church, right down to his teeth. The church he defended, but not necessarily the theology. He made sure his sons went to church, too, but he often dropped them off at the door and then headed down the street to converse with some of his close friends about theology, always returning just in time to pick them up again after Sunday school. Despite his intellectual interest, Joseph McMurrin almost never discussed his ideas with his sons. His only appearances at the ranch were occasional visits during the summer vacation when he helped with bookkeeping chores. And I've gotten the impression, though none of the McMurrins have put it this way, that Sterling's father was, or at least felt, somewhat overshadowed by his father, father-in-law, and wife. He was a thinker, distinguished in appearance, but his life was hardly joyful, and nor was he playful. Looking at the McMurrin-Moss family of Sterling's youth, William Perry's notion of multiple, healthy role models couldn't be scripted more perfectly. Among the most important people in his early experience, all were successful and respected, and they all cared about Sterling. Yet they succeeded and earned respect in very different ways. Grandfather Joseph, a man of the cloth, was an eloquent defender of the region's dominant faith. Grandfather Moss, a man of affairs, wielded power in the world, but always tempered it with compassion. Their mother, Gertrude, thought of herself, thought for herself, loved life, and served without reservation. More than anyone else, she showed how a whole and good life could be put together and lived. Her sons revered her. Father Joseph loved books and words, put ideas first, and got Sterling to read Dante's Divine Comedy and Plato's Republic before he ever left high school. He fed his son's mind. If the task of composing a life is one of recognizing one's own potential and incorporating uniquely a blend of the qualities we admire most in those closest to us, then the conditions were not only favorable for the young McMurrin, but he made the most of them. Sterling had every reason to believe in himself, and he did. Almost everything came naturally and easily to him as a youth. Despite his erratic attendance at school and the Eastern woman's gratuitous statements, he excelled in school and later in college. But he was also a fine athlete, loved basketball, and, of course, horsemanship. He was good-looking and danced with the best of them. He and his high school flame, Marjorie, kept his folks awake many a night, wondering if he would get home before dawn. This, according to younger brother Hal. Neither Sterling nor his brothers recall any significant disappointments or traumas in his early years. Everything seemed to go his way, to build his confidence and to develop his capacities. If there is one thing I might say about my brother as a youth, Hal said, all the way through high school, is that he was a completely normal teenager. Now, in one sense, of course, he was a completely abnormal teenager. Things don't go this well for any normal or average child. But I think in the sense that Hal meant it, he was saying, in fact, that Sterling was a healthy, happy, well-adjusted kid who enjoyed almost everything that kids do. He was not a bookworm, nor was he protected at all from the harsh realities of life. His ranch upbringing took care of that. Sterling's first major lifelong struggle hit when he entered UCLA as a freshman. He suffered an asthma attack that forced him to transfer the next fall to the University of Utah to a drier and cleaner climate, and to give up many of the robust physical activities which had brought him such pleasure as a youth. It was also this asthma, by the way, that kept him at the University of Utah for over 50 years, and to the great benefit of our region. Even so, he took this disappointment of asthma in stride, continuing to love the physical dimensions of life, but at a restricted pace, and participating in them as he could. He never complained or felt sorry for himself, not in the least. On he went to bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Utah, doctorate from the University of Southern California, philosophy, and to the kinds of things that Boyer has described and that we all know with regard to his contributions to this community and to the church. Howard Gardner, in his recent book about seven creators of the modern era, called Creating Minds, examines the lives of Martha Graham, Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, Picasso, Gandhi, and a couple of others. Among other things, he concludes that each of them made a Faustian bargain, whereby, recognizing their special genius, they wrote off everything else in their lives that might have otherwise nurtured them, sometimes family, friends, health, wider interests, and the like. This Sterling never did with his own life, and I think one of the reasons that we're here today and acknowledging the harvest of his life and the kind of affection that so many of us have had for Sterling for so long is the fact that he did not make a Faustian bargain. In many respects, I think the youth, which I've just described to you, inspired in him such self-confidence that he felt no special need to excel in any area. The one regret that he spoke to me many times in recent years was that he never wrote the definitive book that he might have written in the field of philosophy. He often said, "I stayed at administration too long. I should have gotten back. I wish I had done that and not spent so much time at administration." But in another sense, it seems to me, he enjoyed the farm and the ranch. He enjoyed his friends. He enjoyed the university. He enjoyed all the aspects of life to such a degree that he never made a bargain with the devil to excel at an extreme level in any particular area, although he excelled in many, many areas at a very high level. What I'm saying, in effect, was that in many respects, what he might have achieved in one area, such as philosophy, he didn't achieve at the level that he might have, having instead chosen to lead a life which I think reflected the youth from which he came, a life which involved moral and ethical and education and practical affairs all together in a life which was truly rewarding at a most profound level. So the loyalty, I think, that he found to all of the institutions that nurtured him, family, religion, nation, and beyond, were loyalties that he refused to sacrifice in any part as the years passed by. With this, I will conclude my remarks and suggest that we have now about 5 or 10 minutes left for questions, and I hope you'll direct them to us. Thank you.
My name is Lamar Timothy. I was at the University of Utah at the same time Sterling was there, but had very little to do with him in that he was in the moral philosophy area and I was over in computers and stuff like that. My question is to Jack, what was your relationship with Sterling? I perceived that he was rather selective in his friends. If you weren't an intellectual yourself, like Brother Boyer, why, he didn't really spend a lot of time talking with you, but apparently he talked with you a lot, and I'd like to know what that relationship was between you and Sterling.
Uh, I really don't know how to answer that, but I can tell one story that's kind of illustrative, perhaps. He was the senior dean and one of the most esteemed faculty members on the University of Utah campus when I came as the brand-new dean of liberal education and student affairs in 1974. And his office was in 310 Park Building, and mine was in 210 Park Building. And I was in somewhat in awe of Sterling. And as a part of my coming here, I was asked to describe the priorities that I would assign to liberal education at the University of Utah. And I was quoted in the Tribune as indicating that we had to be better advocates and better developers of liberal education, that professional and vocational education had far too much sway. And I got what I describe my well-now young man letter from Sterling McMurrin. With his eloquence, he dressed me down, saying, politely but directly, these two forms of education are not at war with one another. They are, in fact, two parts of the same thing. And never advocate liberal education at the expense of vocational or professional education. Each one nurtures and makes the other better. I responded to that. We got into a long, good conversation about it. By the way, I've never made the mistake again. He was absolutely right. And that led gradually, one thing to the next, to more and more conversations. And I guess that's about all I can say. Thanks, Lamar.
Yes.
Will there be a book from those conversations?
Yes, the book will be entitled Matters of Conscience, Conversations with Sterling McMurrin on Education, Philosophy, and Religion. Signature Press will release it probably in November or December this year. I've got the galleys, not the galleys, but the final proofs from the copy editor on my desk right now.
I was one of the lucky ones who worked at the University of Utah when McMurrin was the dean of the graduate school, when Boyer was there and Jack was there. And I worked, my office was across the hall from him. I was speechwriter to President Fletcher and to President Emery, ran the community forum program in the public relations office. And I always timed my breaks at the time when I knew McMurrin would be at the Coke machine downstairs. So I managed to catch him maybe once or twice or three times a week, and he was a wonderful storyteller. I'll pass just one of them on to you. He told about a time when he was a young man, went to Salt Air and to witness a debate with one of his grandfathers. I don't know if it was Grandfather Moss or Grandfather McMurrin. Time has passed, but he said that in the early days of the church, debate was a respectable thing. It's not so much regarded with favor by the brethren today, but it certainly was in those days. It was the major form of entertainment. And the debate was about some aspect of Mormon theology, and the judge of the debate was the Chief Justice of the Utah Supreme Court. The debate went on for hours, and the judge got up afterwards and said, "Both sides done good." And I think that's true.
Just wanted to say that I was at the U2 with Sterling and Bill Mueller, who was my thesis chairman. And I was much in awe of Sterling, like many of you. He was very close to Bill Mueller, and I saw him rather often at Mueller's house. But I was afraid to speak, and I was afraid to take class from him. And I found out over the years how mistaken I was. He was the most approachable of men, and Natalie was the most gracious of the hostesses, and they invited me into their home later on, and I realized how much I had missed. I was there helping them pack books when they moved to St. George, and we found, Gloria Murdoch found a clean copy of Lowell Bannon's dissertation, written in 1933, given over to Sterling, with the pages still uncut. and we needed this pristine copy, because we want to republish it. And I didn't have a copy. I had read it. So we were delighted. We now have this, and we hope to reprint it. But I just want to say how gracious they were. And as a couple, I think we should do a study of their marriage, because I don't think I've ever seen a more devoted couple in later life. When you sat with them and watched them interact, so often you see couples where if the man has been the dominant one, the wife will, you know, let him talk and maybe needle him and then say, oh, that's an old joke, or I've heard that before or something, and kind of put the pin in. Natalie always just encouraged him, led him along, and would pat his face, and he'd lean over and pat her face. They acted like lovers right to the end.
Thank you, Mary. With that, I think we should conclude the session with the note that succeeding this session, 3:30 to 4:30, is another one on the theological and philosophical foundations of Sterling McMurrin. And Boyer, thank you for a superb paper.